This is BBC Radio 6
Music.
Welcome to a very special Christmas edition of The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shape their lives and their careers. Sometimes a hugely successful band's music can get overlooked. Now, if that sounds odd, what I mean is huge sales, screaming audiences and a strong image can sometimes distract from songs. And maybe that's what happened with a band led by my guest this week. Formed from various groups in Wolverhampton and Warsaw in the Midlands in 1965, it took them till 1971 to have their first hit. A hit that would start a consistent run of massive singles that would include six UK number ones. Overall, they spent a phenomenal 211 weeks in the UK top 40, three UK number one albums, and they were, for a while, the biggest band around. They were Slade. And my guest this week is the voice of the band, Noddy Holder. Noddy quit the group in 1992, but not before he recorded a huge collection of stone-cold classics. Yes, in hindsight, their glam image is easy to mock, but what a back catalogue. Slade fans include Oasis, Kiss, the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, the Clash, and Paul Weller. All these people have paid their respects. Even Kurt Cobain was a fan. And listening to the new box set, When Slade Rocked the World, 71 to 75, you can hear why. Here, Noddy talks about his early years as a member of the Rocking Phantoms and the Memphis Cutouts and the Mavericks, and eventually Ambrose Slade, the group who'd become Slade. He looks back on their breakthrough track, Get Down, Get With It, and the story behind some of their biggest songs, which, yes, does include Merry Christmas, Everybody. He also talked about Slade in Flame, the album and surprisingly gritty movie that the group made, which was ignored by fans at the time but since become a hugely respected cult classic, and also includes some of their best ever songs. But I started by asking Noddy, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, I first got interested in music when I would probably be about 4 years old. And my dad bought what was called in them days a radiogram. It's like a piece of furniture, like a sideboard in the living room. One big speaker, and it was a radio built into it and a turntable. And I remember him bringing the first 78 home, funnily enough. It was very early 50s. And it was Via Con Dios by the Beverly Sisters.
Via Con Dios, my darling. Via Con Dios, my love. Now the village mission bells are softly ringing. Heart, you'll hear them singing. Via Con Dios, my darling.
But he used to sing round the clubs, working men's clubs, amateur. He used to do Sinatra and the jazz standards, the swing standards. And he was a good singer, my dad. He never had any ambitions to be professional or whatever, and I don't think he ever earned any money from it. He never got paid. He just loved to get up and sing to the punters. 1953, because I used to sing and entertain around the house a bit, to the radiogram and the records he used to bring home. Al Jolson was his favourite, and so I used to do a lot of Al Jolson stuff. In them days, what today would be called karaoke, in those days it was called free and easy. And it was usually a Sunday night at a workingman's club. You didn't have a karaoke machine. You didn't have a machine to sing to. But they had a piano player. And if you were in a club with a height of luxury, you might have a drummer as well. So you'd sing the hits of the day and anybody could get up. My dad used to get up every week. And one Sunday, he grabbed me up on stage and said, "You sing a song." And at the time, the number one record was I Believe, you know, the standard I Believe, but the Frankie Lane version. And I knew all the words, so I sang it in what was like a soprano voice in those days. And it brought the place down.
I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows. I believe that somewhere in the darkest night, a candle glows. I believe for everyone who goes astray, someone will come to show the way. I believe,
that was my first taste of applause, and it was downhill all the way from then on. I mean, I got the taste of it. So music then was a major influence and interest in my life. And then I discovered 55, 56, rock and roll came along. Because before then, it had been all the balladeers that you heard on the radio at that time, on the BBC particularly, but they were all singing with big bands. But then rock and roll came along with Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley. But the one that really floored me was Little Richard.
Because didn't you see him live when you were...
I saw him live in the 60s.
How old were you when you saw him?
When I first saw him on screen, I'd be 11.
Right.
I'd heard him on what was in those days Radio Luxembourg. I'd heard his records. But didn't imagine what he looked like. Couldn't imagine what... Because you didn't in those days. There wasn't mass media. So you heard these records, but you didn't know who half the people looked like. Because they'd not been on TV in Britain by that time, especially black artists. There was a film coming around called The Girl Can't Help It, which featured a lot of rock and rollers, Eddie Cochran and quite a few people. And I saw Little Richard was in this movie performing. And I thought, I wonder what he looks like. And I was too young to get into the cinema for that movie. So the lad who lived next door to me was a bit older. Whenever there was a bit of film that was the wrong rating for me to get in, he used to let me in the back door of the cinema. So I saw Rock Around the Clock, Blackboard Jungle, all those movies before I was old enough to go in, because he'd let me in the back door. So Girl Can't Help It came on, and Little Richard came on the screen, and I was aghast. He was black, shiny silk suit, pompadour hairstyle, all greased piled up on his head, thick makeup. His band were cooking behind him, swinging the saxes and everything. But the main thing that hit me was he was standing up playing the piano. We'd never in Britain seen anybody standing up playing the piano before. You know, you had your Winifred Atwell and artists like this, but they all sat down playing the piano. But he was rocking away, and the voice just floored me. And I came out the cinema that day, and it was like an epiphany, really. I thought, this is what I want to do. This was just amazing for me. As a kid of that age, I'd be 10 or 11. And I thought, this is incredible. I wish one day I could do this.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it. Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
She walks by the mean folks getting gross.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she winks an eye, the grass lights turn to toad.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
Become well done.
Can't help it, girl can't help it.
She made grandpa feel like 21.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
The girl can't help it, she was born to please.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
And if I go to her on bending knee.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
Oh, won't you kindly be aware that I can't help it.
I can't help it.
When you first started playing guitar, who were your guitar heroes? Who did you want to be?
When I first got a guitar, my dad bought me a guitar from an old tat shop. It cost about £4, which was quite a lot of money in those days, really. But it was an old banger of a guitar. And I started to be able to play a few chords on it. And my mum said, well, I know somebody who's a great guitar player. I used to watch him go and play with his quartet. And it was a guy called Freddie Degville, who used to have a band playing Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli type Hot Club of France type songs. He was a jazz player. And I said, he'll show you the chords and a few rudimentary things. You know, he didn't play pop music, but he played proper guitar. So I went to him for a few lessons and he taught me a few of the jazz standards. And that's what got me into Django Reinhardt, which I love today. My youngest kid, my son, is named Django after Django Reinhardt. And so I was learning all sorts of music. I was learning jazz stuff from him. I was learning pop stuff from the records, from the chords that I didn't know. I mean, most pop records in those days were just four chords anyway. But the thing in those days was getting the lyrics off the record. So you had to keep putting the needle on the vinyl and whizzing it back and forth because you hadn't got any other way of getting the lyrics. So you had to keep playing them over and over again. And of course, on a lot of rock and roll records, the lyrics were very difficult to get. It was a bit of... and so it was a bit awkward to get some of the lyrics. So quite often, when you start playing with your own group of mates in your first band, you're probably off, the lyrics were wrong anyway. But gradually you get better and better. And I stuck with it. I practiced and practiced and practiced. I mean, I've never really rated myself as a great guitar player, but I can play all styles of guitar.
What Django track should we play?
Oh, Django track. Well, my favourite ever Django track. And it's just the melody is just stunning. And it's been covered by many, many artists. And it's called Nuage. It's very smooth. And the chord progressions in it are just superb. I formed my first band in probably 59, 60 at school.
What were they called?
They were called the Rockin' Phantoms.
That's not a bad name.
Not a bad name.
It's all right, that.
It was all right, especially in those days. And we had a singer as well as me. I sang and played lead guitar in the band because I was the best guitarist in the band. So I played lead. And we had a singer as well called John E. Blue. So it was John E. Blue and the Rockin' Phantoms. But then he jacked it in, and then I took over all the vocal duties. And we used to do working men's clubs, weddings, youth clubs, a lot of youth clubs in those days, and really playing the pops of the day and rock and rolly stuff like Elvis stuff, Everly Brothers, especially Everly Brothers, we love them, Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, so all that stuff, which then led on to the 60s when the explosion came of bands a la Liverpool Beat, the Mersey Beat scene.
So technically, the first Slade band was In-Betweens, wasn't it?
Yep, that was in 1966. I'd been in the Rockin' Phantoms, I'd been in the Memphis Cutouts, which was when we went more R&B. And then there was a singer in the Midlands called Steve Brett, who had his own TV series in those days. And he had the Beatles as guests on his show, Jerry and the Pacemakers. A lot of those bands were guests on his show. And he was quite a big star locally in the Midlands. And his band left him, the Mavericks, they were called. And he asked us to be his new Mavericks. And we said, yeah, because he'd been on telly. And it gave us a chance to turn professional and earn a bit more money. And then with him, we made our first foray into the German scene, playing the German clubs. So there we could be playing in the week, six sets a night, which would be 45 minutes on, 15 minutes off, 45 on, 50 minutes off.
Blimey.
So we did 9 till 3 or 4 in the morning in the week. And on the weekend, we could be doing 14 sets on a Saturday.
You're going to get good, aren't you?
We'd start at 2 in the afternoon and go all the way through till 4 in the morning. And that's what tightens you up as a band. And, and you learn your chops. You learn how to work an audience because you had to, you know, you've got a long night ahead of you. Up till about 11 or 12 o'clock, it was German, young German kids. So you do the pop hits of the day for them. Then there was a curfew under 18 in those days. So they'd all leave the club. Then the adult Germans would come in and the American GIs because there's so many GI bases. So if you're in the north of Germany, it'd be the sailors that come in. And in the southern towns like Frankfurt and Cologne, it'd be the GIs would come in. A lot of them black GIs. Well, they wanted to hear black R&B music. And my lineup then in the Mavericks, we had saxes and keyboards, so we could do any sorts of stuff. So we'd start the set for the GIs with I Go Crazy, James Brown, and we'd be doing Sam and Dave and Wilson Pickett stuff. And they loved it. Because we were a white band doing black music. So they absolutely loved it. And they'd buy, in the 15-minute interval, if you did a request for them, if they wanted a request and you did it, they'd buy you a bottle of beer and a cognac chaser.
There you go.
So in the interval, you could have 10 beers and cognac chasers on the table, but you'd got to drink them in the 15-minute break. Because if you didn't drink them, the waiters would come and shift them and go and flog them in the club and make the money. But of course, you were playing to a real mixed crowd. You were playing to gangsters with shooters in their coats. You'd be playing to hookers because it was that late night scene. It was a raunchy scene. And a raunchy scene always dictates they want raunchy music. But of course, about 3 o'clock in the morning, you shattered. It was all sex and drugs and rock and roll. You shattered. So the last set of the night would always be for 45 minutes. You play Booker T and Booker T's Green Onions, just jamming. And we were like, do. So you'd be jamming that for 45 minutes. We were out of it, and the crowd were even more out of it. So it all worked great. But you learned so many lessons doing that. Because you had to, I mean, we could play probably 100 songs and play them well.
I want security, yeah. And I want it in the evening, alright. Security, yeah. Come on, give me your loving at night. Don't want no money, no. Don't want no payments, it's a pity I can't have you.
Because even the first Slade single was a soul cover, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it was a Little Richard cover, or so we thought, and we credited him on the record as writing it. Because he had the record out, and I heard it in a club, and I thought, this would be great for us. This would be just perfect for what we were doing at the time. Mm. And we started to do it on stage. It used to go a storm, and we'd recorded quite a few things. And had a couple of singles out, and Chas Chandler said, our producer and manager, he said, I really think we should try and get down and get with it down in the studio, because it got such a storm on stage. It could have a chance, if we can get radio play, of being a hit record. It sums up what the band's about anyway. And so we did it. We got it down. It started to get radio play slowly and slowly but surely. And we'd put down Pennyman, which is Little Richard's surname, as the writer. But we got sued pretty much when it was a hit. Because he hadn't written it at all. He claimed he'd written it, but he hadn't. It was a record from way back, and he just took it and put his writing credits on it.
I didn't know that. That's
yeah.
Well, all right, everybody, let your hair down. If you got on a wig like some people think I got on, and this is my own beautiful hair, what to do with the fellas? Take it out! I said, and get down and win it.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Talking about soul, Aretha Franklin is someone that you've spoken about as being your favourite...
Favourite all-time female singer.
When did you first fall in love with her and what track should we play?
Oh, lordy, lordy. Well, I like all her records, all those 60s records, because we used to dance to them in the clubs. They were great soul records. And we used to play some of them on stage. The one I'd like you to play, which is not a hit from UK, but it was a hit in the States. The reason we knew of it and the reason we did play it was we had a stint in the Bahamas in 68.
Tough life, isn't it?
Yeah. We got took over there to play in some clubs in the Bahamas, and we thought we were supposed to be playing in the posh hotel end, but we ended up in the black end of the island in the nitty-gritty clubs. So there again, the tourists, the white tourists would come in till about 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and then at 12 o'clock, the black audience would come in. And there again, they'd never seen a white act playing soul. They had a jukebox in the corner of the club with all the classic soul records on it, and they loved soul music in the Bahamas. They absolutely loved it. But they'd never seen anybody play it live, black acts included, because the black acts out there were doing calypsos and reggae types and ska. And, of course, the American kids out there, they would bring us records from the States that never been released in UK yet. I mean, we came back with songs like Born to be Wild, Steppenwolf, never been released in Britain at that time. So we were doing that in our stage act way before it was a single over here.
That's brilliant.
And it became known for us, and people didn't realise it was Steppenwolf. But the Aretha Franklin track we picked up over there was a song called The House That Jack Built. And we started to include that in the show in the Bahamas, brought it back to UK as well, and was doing it in the UK. And so that's the one. I think it's a great, great soul record. Fabulous soul record.
This is a house that Jack built, y'all. Remember this house. This was the land that he worked by hand. It was the dream of an upright man. There was a room that was filled with love. It was a love that I was proud of. This is the life that he planned. All the love, the same old love. In the house that Jack built.
The house that Jack built.
Aretha Franklin with a wonderful The House That Jack Built, the choice of my guest on the special Christmas First Time, Slade's Noddy Holder.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and this is a very special Christmas edition of The First Time on Six Music, where we look back at the key first moments in an artist's career. And that song was Come On, Feel the Noise by Slade, and my guest this week is the unmistakable voice of the band, Noddy Holder.
First number one, 1971, 'Cause I Love You.
Yeah.
That's a good moment, I presume.
It was a good moment.
Because it's taken a long time to get it. It's taken
a long time. We formed in 66. We got in first number one in 71. So we've been going a long time and we've been playing everywhere we could in Britain. But it took us all that time to get a record away. A, because of the image. People were a bit scared of us because we had a spell of skinheads in the late 60s.
That's right.
So people got very frightened of us. When they saw us live...
Really?
Yeah. Charles, our manager, he wanted us to have an image to set us aside from everybody else. And skinhead thing wasn't a political thing in those days.
Just a look.
Just fashion. But it frightened people off. It frightened TV producers off. It frightened radio producers. So we had very little exposure on TV and radio until Get Down and Get With It. And then we started to colour the image up. We really kept the look, but made it colourful. So people didn't regard it as a skinhead thing anymore. And it became the early days of glam rock alongside T-Rex, what they were doing. And Charles, our manager, said, you next hit, have to Get Down and Get With It. You've done a cover, you've got a big hit out of it. He said, don't come back to me until you've written a hit single. Well, how'd you do that? So Jim come round my mum's one afternoon when we were up in Wolverhampton, when I was at my mum's, and he come round with his violin. And before we went on stage to tune up the instruments, we always did a bit of Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli jazzy stuff. And we got this rhythm and this sort of pattern that was based on Django style. And Jim said, he got his violin, he said, that thing we do tuning up, let's try that as a rhythm basis for a song. And we were just playing it, and I just sang a melody over the top of it, really, just dead simple lyrics. And within 20 minutes, we'd written it.
20 minutes?
20 minutes. Seriously, 20 minutes. We were just... Jim, Jim, Jim. And it sounded catchy, but we thought, is it too simple? You know, it's only three chords. We took it to the other two, we played it to them, we rehearsed it, we went in the studio, we probably did it in two or three takes. And we'd complete it in a day. But when we heard it back, it didn't sound Slade enough, especially following Get Down and Get With It. So we thought, well, what did we do on Get Down and Get With It? Of course, we put the hand claps and the foot stamping on it. So we thought, let's try that on this. It Slade-ified it. It came out, and within 2 weeks, it was number one.
I have to ask you about Merry Christmas, everybody. What's your relationship like with that song now? Because I've done this with lots of artists, and sometimes you have a song, you're lucky enough to have a song that really makes an impact where it doesn't belong to you anymore.
Sure.
It belongs to the world. And that relationship with the song can come and go depending on all manner of factors.
I've never had a problem with Merry Christmas, everybody. I've always been proud of it.
Yeah.
I never thought when we wrote it and recorded it in 73, never thought 42 years later it would still be being played just as much. Never for a minute did we think it would survive that length of time. Because in those days, you didn't think that. You know, you thought you made a record, you hoped it would be a number one record, you hoped to sell a million with it, and that was it. You thought, after that's gone, you know, it'll be probably played here and there. But you never think for a minute that record, all those, any of those records, will go on 40-odd years later. You just didn't imagine it would happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not our biggest song around the world. It is in Europe, but around the world, it's probably Come On, Feel the Noise and My Oh My, funnily, a big hit we had in the 80s around the world. Most people don't even know we had any other hits. I don't think we had 40 hits. I don't even think when I hear it, it's dated. It still has something fresh to it. It's as if it was yesterday we recorded it.
The legend on the internet, which means it's completely untrue, is that it's about you make about £1 million a year from it.
I never comment on how much money we make out of it every year. Are you hanging up, stopping on your wall?
want to talk about Slade and Flame, which came out in 75.
Yeah.
When it first came out, the film, it missed the mark a little bit, but now it's gone on to become this enormously respected first cult and now mainstream movie. And it's got possibly two of your best songs, I think, on it.
Absolutely.
Far, Far Away and How Does It Feel? Yeah. It must be quite nice knowing that, okay, maybe we didn't, maybe it wasn't meant for then, but now these
years I think later, you're right. I think you've hit the nail on the head. When the movie came out, the critics were great. Mm. Barry Norman gave it a great critique, and he's hard to please. And so did most of the critics. But the fans didn't take to it that easily because they didn't want to see this arguing, nitty-gritty, behind-the-scenes thing they're expecting to get from us, a slapstick, run-around, Hard Day's Night type of movie. Because we're a happy-go-lucky band. Me and Jim, especially, we were determined we were not going to make a film that was expected of us.
Like a Monkees movie,
yeah. Because we thought it was just too expected of us and too simple to get away with, really. The first script we had was actually by the right-hand man of our manager, Chas Chandler. He's a guy called Johnny Steele, who used to be the drummer in The Animals, the band he was in. And he came up with a script originally called The Quite a Mess Experiment, which was a Mickey take on The Quite a Mess Experiment, where I was going to be playing Professor Quatermass. It was a comedy. And Davil was going to be eaten by a triffid in the first half hour. We're just going to leave his hair hanging out the triffid's mouth. Like. So Dave was having none of that. So that one went by the by. Anyway, there's a guy called Andrew Birkin came up with a screenplay of What Was Flame. Andrew Birkin was the brother of Jane Birkin, Jetem fame. And he wrote the first treatment of this story of a rock and roll band. And it was nitty-gritty. But it wasn't actually true to life. It's what people think a band's like on the road, but not really what it was. So we took him, and who was to be the director, Richard Lundgren, who became a big director, but this was his first movie. We took him on the road to America to see what it was like on the road, to learn some real stories on the road. And they should have been on the road with us for 6 weeks. I think they lasted 2 weeks. They both came back with nervous breakdowns. But they learnt a lot of stories on the way, on plane journeys and that. So every scene you see in the movie is true story, not particularly to Slade, but to some band somewhere. It formulated into Flame then. And when it came out, it wasn't a big success box office-wise that should have been of our stature as a band at the time, because people were shocked. They were shocked by it. Anyway, as you say now, 20 years pass, and it starts to gain momentum as a cult movie. And a lot of it to do with the music or in it, yet let alone the story. But now it is a valid movie, and people like Mark Kermode cite it as one of the best rock movies ever made. And as you say, Far, Far Away and How Does It Feel? Two classic songs that came out of that movie. How Does It Feel was one of the smallest hits we ever had. We'd had top three hits up to that point. And we bought How Does It Feel out, and nobody wanted to know. The radio didn't play it. The band didn't like it except me and Jim. The record company didn't like it. The only reason they put it out was because it was the theme tune for the movie. They didn't actually like the record because it weren't Slade enough. But now, people cite it as one of their favourite Slade songs.
How does it feel running around, round, round? How does it feel watching from upside down? 'Cause many years from now there will be new sensations and new temptations. How does it feel? How does it feel right at the start? When you are thrown.
sometimes think, actually, you know, we deserved a bit more respect. We were a bit deeper than maybe sometimes people thought, because these songs have stood up.
Certainly Jim thinks that way, that we didn't get the respect that we deserved, but he always put it down to the way we looked, our silly image, like, and he hated it. He hated all that dressing up and things like that. But we always, myself and Dave, always, even when we first formed the band, we always said, we want a complete package. We want the music, but we want the look, we want the image. Wherever we walked on stage or we walked on TV, people go, whoa, and they did. And that was the thing. But it did sort of take your mind away from the music. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, we were probably the biggest band going at that time, so it didn't do any harm at the time. It's just for musical respect, I think we get a... You wait your time out, and it comes to you eventually, and that's what's happened to us, I think.
What do you miss about the band?
I don't miss anything about the band now, because I...
Because you've been busy enough.
I've had a different career. I suppose I'd have to say I missed originally the camaraderie of a touring circus around the world, of being let loose. It was like the marauding hordes.
The Vikings.
travelling around
Vikings.
The world. And we took no prisoners, either with audiences or anything. I mean, the hit records are icing on the cake, really. Our forte was the live show. You know, we were up there with the top guns around the world for the live show, because we were a great live band. But of course, with every band, we'd been together 25 years, with every band, it happens to every single band going. When you're living in one of those pockets, day in, day out, 24/7, the cracks begin to show, because you can't possibly keep that momentum up. And we were same four guys in the lineup. We hadn't had any change of lineup. You're not that little young gang. You know, you've got families, you're getting older, you're getting more mature. Egos start to come into play. Money starts to come into play. Sex and drugs and rock and roll comes into play. So it's not the same format as the years go on and on and on. So I made the decision that I wasn't having fun with it anymore, particularly. And I always said, the day I stop having fun, I will go off and try something else. And that's exactly what happened, really. But I didn't just drop them in it. I'll give them 5 years notice. I said, I'm going to jack it in 5 years. So, you know, I gave them plenty of time.
Is there any chance that the friendships within the band would kind of repair enough for the door to some kind of reunion ever be open?
I don't
again?
Think so. Now, it's not as if we don't talk to one another. We don't see one another very often, and we don't sort of communicate that often. The times we have sat in a room together has not been very successful. It's like, but that's the same with every band. You know, the same things come up as happened 20 years ago.
The tambourine you did in that track in 1976 ruined that album.
It's not quite that bad, but it's along those lines.
But you've got the legacy now.
We're proud of what we did. We had a great time. In that 25 years the original lineup was together, we did have a great time for most of the time.
And the final thing, we've had all these firsts, is we get you to pick the final track, the last song. What should we play?
I think I should pick one of Slade, shouldn't I, really? I'll pick Far, Far Away. It wasn't this big rowdy anthem. It was an uplifting track, but it did sum up our life at the time on the road. We were constantly touring. We hardly ever got home. If we weren't touring, we were in the recording studio doing the next album. So this was all about the places we'd seen. If we hadn't been in a rock and roll band, all our mates at home never went to Japan or Australia or Alaska or any of these strange places we ended up in. And this Far, Far Away was a song about all these places we'd visited. But that was all great. But we still had got our toys at home that we very rarely were getting home to see. And so you did have periods. We used to have about 6 months into a tour. We'd call it tour madness, because then your whole normal life had disappeared because you'd grown out of that for the last 6 months touring.
Well, that's the last song we shall play. And as someone from the Midlands who was born on the day that Mama We're All Crazy Now was number one, it's been great to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Keep on rocking.
I've seen the yellow lights go down the Mississippi. I've seen the bridges of the world and they're for real. I've had a red light on the wrist without me even getting kissed. It still seems so unreal. I've seen the morning in the mountains of Alaska. I've seen the sunset in the
BBC Radio 6 Music.
To join in and let it all happen. Enjoy yourselves.